Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Dr. Simon Marshall. Simon is a former Associate Professor of Family and Preventative Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. I first met Simon through his wife, Leslie. Do you remember Leslie Patterson is the triathlete I interviewed and we talked about The Brave Athlete, their new book, which is absolutely phenomenal. Simon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris. It's good to be on with a fellow Brit too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I really enjoyed. So I went and stayed with Simon in San Diego. Leslie, after our interview, she very graciously invited me to stay with Simon for the weekend.
Yeah, yeah. She was gracious in inviting you while she wasn't there and I had to deal with you.
It's true. And it turned into a great big therapy stroke coaching session for me and my business and sports endeavors, which I very much appreciated, Simon. Thank you very much.
Oh, no. I just appreciated that you came with enough ready meals for your entire stay. So that was perfect. No cooking needed on my part.
Julie is unbelievable at doing that. You know, there's really no reason to eat any bars, any kind of like fast food or anything with her. She packs me off with all of this incredible food in Pyrex containers with silicone lids. And I travel with all of it. So I flew down to San Diego and I swear to God, I didn't eat another thing that Julie had not prepared for me. And I did the Belgian waffle ride, which was nearly 9 hours on the bike. And I still had enough food for everything, which was fantastic.
That's probably because you didn't share any with me.
Exactly, exactly. But you looked as if you were pretty competent. You knew your way around the kitchen. I didn't feel sorry for you. But that was a great weekend. I learned so much from you. In fact, I went on to mastermind talks, an entrepreneurial event, which I spent a fortune on, thousands and thousands of dollars. And I feel like I definitely got better value for money from the weekend from you. But I honestly, if I'd have spent thousands of dollars on that weekend with you, I would have been just as happy.
I'd have just settled for a small slice of your meatloaf.
But yeah, you introduced me to the concept of radical candor that was absolutely
fantastic. Oh, yes.
So Tommy and I did a podcast on that and then I missed the most important bit. So Tommy and I did a coaching call with Simon after we recorded the interview and you said, you've got to criticize in private and praise in public. And of course, we didn't talk about that in the interview and we realized we'd done it all wrong. So
that's right. While you're busy sort of laying into someone in a public arena of all the things they've got wrong.
Oh my goodness. I'm sorry about that, everyone.
We've all done it.
Yeah. Well, read the book. That's what maybe my recommendation should be. You just read the book, Radical Candor by Kim Scott. I'll link to that in the show notes. Oh, I didn't mention you are a sports psychologist and you work with Team BMC. So you're doing sports psychology at the very highest international level, which I think is very, very cool. Talk to me about how you got involved in psychology in the first place. Obviously, you had an undergraduate degree that was in a somewhat unrelated field. Am I right in thinking that? So how did you become so interested in psychology?
Well, no, I did my undergraduate degree in the sports sciences in the UK, and you specialize in sort of the biomechanics and exercise physiology and psychology. And then in your final year, you specialize in one of those. And mine was psychology. And I've been a cyclist, a competitive cyclist since kind of the age of, I don't know, God, 10 or 12 or so on. And I was always fascinated by the mental side of sport, probably because I was trying to figure out the reasons for my own mediocrity, convinced that they were just, you know, it was just something that I was missing. And once I'd learned that, I'd be. And so I got really interested in it and started to study a bit more. So I did a master's degree and then eventually led on to a PhD. But the interesting thing about sports psychology is that, well, not interesting, but one of the features of it, it's really sport is just the environment in which you're studying psychological approaches to approaching things in life that are stressful or cause concern. And so it applies to lots of different areas. And so my academic life ended up branching off into more health psychology and working in public health departments. That was my faculty position at UCSD. But I've always had an interest in sports psychology as an academic interest, but also more recently in a practical interest. Yeah, so working with athletes, I'm married to a professional athlete. And if there's one thing that, you know, will help any sports psychologist be better at their job is marry into it, because you get to peek behind the curtain of what actually goes on. And up until that point, you rely on athletes telling you the truth or telling you how they see the world, and you rely on their ability to, or you're trusting them that they're doing the things that you're asking and discussing. And that may not be the case. And you may never know this. And it was really only until I married a professional athlete that really my approach, my whole philosophy to mental training for athletes changed in quite a significant way.
Is there anyone else on the planet that's quite like you? You think you are quite a unique combination?
No, I'm not. I don't think I'm that unique. I mean, obviously, it's kind of a niche-y area anyway, right? Sports psychology and public health or behavioral medicine, which is how it's dressed up in to make it academically credible, right? But I think there are a few of us. There are not that many. I think I'm mainly driven by a really strong sort of intellectual curiosity about why we make decisions the way we do and why we think and feel the way we do. And sport is a lovely environment to study that because it has all the sort of the ingredients of being feeling like $1 million and then also feeling like a total loser and all within the hour. So, I think that's what a lot of psychologists are attracted to. It's an achievement domain, as they call it. It's a great avenue for not just being able to learn about how you think and feel about things, but also to develop some resilience and training with adversity and without having to do it in more traumatic and hurtful ways.
What did you learn about yourself? Did you become a much better athlete after you'd become an expert in the domain?
It depends what you mean by better. I think I became a more grateful athlete. And I think that one of the things that helped me do was to be able to, one, not get too burdened by social comparison and expectation and pressure and really learn about how to engage with a sport for its own sake. And this is the ultimate challenge for all athletes, is that the goal is to get really lost in the process, not the outcome of the, you know, executing the skill. And once you're able to do that, you kind of don't give a shit anymore about who's there or how fast other people are or whether you're perfectly prepared for this A race. You just kind of see it as another experience. And I think, and as I've picked up along the way, so few of my ideas are actually my own. We kind of inherit them, right? We read about them and you kind of internalize them and integrate them into your own way of thinking. And some of those are like radical candor. It's about how you define failure and actually seeing it as guidance and seeing it as opportunities to learn more about how to be better next time. And it's kind of remarkably freeing once you're able to do that. And my wife, Leslie, is able to do that now. And I think it's no coincidence when that shift happened, she won 3 world titles after being an average pro triathlete. And she went to being quite remarkable simply by having that new mindset. And so it's quite powerful.
Interesting. So what about athletes on Team BNC? You make me think that they don't care about results. Is that how it works? Like they don't really care whether they get
the
result or not?
No, I mean, obviously all athletes care about results. And if they tell you they don't care, they're lying. And the higher you go up in the sport, meaning if it becomes not just part of your identity, but part of your survival, meaning, well, not physical survival, but financial and social survival, then it absolutely means everything because it drives your contract and your negotiations for further contracts and performances and how you fit into teams and stuff. So it is important. The paradox of it is that the best way to get the outcome you desire is to not focus on it, is to focus on the elements that lead you there. And at the core of that is having a very much of a sort of this process focus, like what can I do in the here and now? And when we say that, we often mean in the next minute or in the next 5 minutes to be the best athlete I can be. What do I need to focus on? And that winning that battle is pretty universal, whether you're riding the Tour de France or the Vuelta or whether you're doing the first 5K and struggling to get through it.
And do you think this is also applicable for other areas? So, for example, weight loss, I feel like that's been a trap that I've seen, is people who are unhappy with their current body composition. And they believe that they're going to be happy once they reach this new desired composition. And then, of course, once you get to that new desired competition, there's something else to be unhappy with. So you kind of have to be happy now before you can be happy later, if that makes sense.
Exactly. And I think it's sort of, it's the human condition, right, is to be predominantly horizon seeking, that it's never in, one of the probably most consistent themes in the age group athletes I work with is that this notion that I'm not enough. It's not articulated as that, but it's a thematic thing that runs through the way they talk about what they do and what drives them. So it's always that once this happens, once I get there, I'll be happy and then everything will be enough and I'll feel enough. And the cruel reality, of course, is that that rarely happens, if ever, because we know, there've been studies on lottery winners and, when you think that you have what you believe is the, you've reached the sort of nadir of happiness, then you are equally unhappy or you're striving for the next thing. And so it's this cyclical sort of reasoning or cyclical process that tortures us. And Leslie's a good example, is that she won a world title and in her professional sport, off-road triathlon. And you'd think that this was the pinnacle of everything you could achieve. And you celebrate, you do, but within hours, it was not probably within a few hours, but within a day or two, it then becomes, but if that might have been a fluke, to be a real champion, I have to defend it. And then when you've won two world titles, people say they're the real deal. But, you know, on the day, oh, you got lucky, or the so-and-so wasn't there, and it's never enough. And we know that. And coming to grips with that, and the sooner we can learn that, it doesn't mean that you cease to strive, but you know that it's like a little hamster's treadmill, a hamster's wheel, right? There'll always be something more that you strive for.
Yeah. So you're reminding me, I've just had a really good time reading The Subtle Art of Not Giving a... Have you read that book?
Yes, yes. It's great, isn't it?
Absolutely. So who is it? I've forgotten the name of the... Mark Manson. Mark Manson is the name of the author. And he talks about there's no such thing as the end of problems, only better problems. And he illustrates this example with the homeless man on the street and Warren Buffett. They've both got money problems. It's just that Warren Buffett has got better money problems. And so the same might be true with Leslie, right? So before, her problem was she hadn't won the world championship. And then once she won the world championship, she just had other better problems.
I know. And the problems, you just kind of, you know, you level up, but the striving is still there, that fire in the belly. And I think, you know, psychologists have studied, and not just psychologists, but neuroscientists and cognitive psychologists have studied why they think this is. It's a pretty universal feeling, and it's the source of much of our mental anguish in life. And one of the things I love about Mark Manson's sort of conclusion is, you know, this notion that getting more mindful or process thinking or staying in the moment is a useful way to live. And he always talks about, you know, the subtle art of not giving a fuck is when you have no more fucks left to give. And, you know, so you've really kind of, it's not saying that you don't care, but it's not occupying all of your thoughts at that moment about what hasn't happened yet or what's happened in the past. It's just about the experience of it in that moment. And we give lip service to this a lot because it's easy to say, and it's very hard to do. To be truly mindful, or whatever what you want to call it. It's really hard to do on a daily basis because you do get pissed off or you get elated or on a moment by moment basis, and learning how to control some of that is difficult.
Simon, since we've already gone there and done some swearing and recently...
No.
I don't want you to apologize. I want you to talk about the use and abuse maybe of swearing. I did have one listener complain that they listen to the podcast in their car, and sometimes their granddaughter is present and they're worried about the swearing. And I have to say, my daughter's 3.5 and I swear in front of her all the time. And I've been to see some other friends in England here, and they do the same. And in fact, one friend said to me that it's important that you do swear, because if you don't, it becomes forbidden fruit, and that encourages them to do it even more. So, but I know that you had some really interesting insight on the use of swearing and how it can change meaning. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if it's a deep insight, but I'm fascinated. I've come from a family of swearers as well, and I like to consider myself a prolific swearer. And I'm married to a Scots woman, so that's obviously DNA anyway, as you know. And I think linguistic scientists or language scientists, they study about why do people swear and the value it serves. I'm interested in it professionally as a sports psych person, and we know the studies show that, you know, swearing improves your pain tolerance. And so when you're doing it, short, sharp, explosive activities or actions that are quite difficult in terms of intensity wise or effort wise, and swearing seems to ameliorate some of those, enables you to perform better. And that's quite a robust finding in the psychological science. So it clearly has a function, because we all do it. But what I find interesting is the taboo part of it. And again, I'm not sure if I have any real deep insight here, but what we know is a myth, for example, that people who swear a lot is a sign of a stunted or limited vocabulary. And in fact, the opposite is true. There might be some selection bias on how they study this, but the notion that people swear because they don't have a sufficient vocabulary to use words that are less taboo is false. So it becomes then a very personal thing about what you do and how you do it. And I don't know who said this, but I always like it, because they say that, you know, offense is taken at the ear, not just at the mouth. So it means that the perception of that word, it means different things to different people. Some people will be outraged by it. We've just written a book that has the F word in the title with one of the letters redacted. So I suppose that saves us somewhat, but we've had complaints and people in the endurance media refuse to review the book because it has swearing, it's setting a bad example and so on. And I'm not sure that's the case. I don't know if there's any evidence behind, you know, suggesting that young people are corrupted by hearing F words in their child. They probably hear a lot worse than that. So I think it's partly to do with how, particularly if you've got young kids, and how you, once they're old enough to be able to have a discussion about it, what swearing means and when do we do it, and if it's not gratuitous or if it's used to inject some levity into a conversation. And, you know, I've spent 10 or 12 years teaching undergraduates and graduate students, and not that I swear prolifically in that, I don't want to get thrown out of the university, but I do know that when you can inject some humor, and swearing isn't a great way of injecting levity and humor, then it does assist in learning. So I would make the case for use it selectively and appropriately and responsibly, but also don't hold back. I mean, I find it strange that people will say, you know, what the frick, or they'll just substitute when everyone knows what the other word is. I don't know how that recuses you from all those things. So I just say, fuck it.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I do it is because that's how I speak in real life. And when I record the podcast, I bring my whole authentic self to the interview. So I guess if I really tried hard, I imagine that, you know, my mum was here or your mum was here, I could probably do it without swearing. But I figured that's probably not what people want to listen to.
Right, exactly.
I wanted to talk to you about behavior change. I really wanted to talk to you about this. And we started this business where we're trying to improve people's health. And I think we're doing a really good job of that in the current population that we're working with, which is athletes. And I'm worried that as we get bigger and expand, the problem of behavior change is going to get much more serious. And so maybe I should give you my story as an illustrative example. I was just doing what I was told with the whole sports performance thing, right? So the cardiologist told me that I shouldn't be eating fat, right? So it was Teflon, everything. My coach told me that I needed the maltodextrin gels on long rides and hard rides. So I was slamming all these maltodextrin gels. I realized with hindsight, I made some really bad decisions by following expert advice. And then later on, when things stopped working for me, I found some different experts that gave me different advice. And it wasn't so much about evidence as it was credibility to me. They sounded like they knew what they were talking about and they'd seen this problem before. And so I followed their advice and I got fantastic results. And the same was true with my wife. You know, she said, oh, well, you've done this elimination diet and you've got rid of dairy and gluten, but now you're eating a ton of nuts and seeds. And those are also common food allergens. And so maybe we need to rethink that. And for me, the behavior change was as simple as it could possibly be. You know, once she said, I just didn't know, you know, it was just the lack of the information. And as soon as she gave me that information, it was the diet, you know, the nuts and the seeds were gone the next day. Do you see what I mean? So for me, I've never had a behavior change problem. If you tell me the right answer, I can just start doing it tomorrow. But I know that's not true for everyone else. And so if we ever expand out of this niche of working with athletes, I'm worried that we're going to be unable to change behavior, because I feel like that's where the bulk of improvements are coming from, is changing behavior. So can you talk about the importance of behavior change in not just the athlete community, but the people that you've been studying as an academic?
Yes. I mean, behavior change is quite a complex issue. I mean, on the face of it, we're told and marketed that it's quite simple. And the obvious example that people trot out is Nike's sort of, you know, just do it.
Right.
What's wrong with it? And your experience, I should say, is pretty unusual, because we know that providing or increasing educational knowledge is not a very effective strategy for behavior change. I mean, it might change things in the short term, but even that, it rarely does. It makes people smarter. It just doesn't usually change their behavior. And there's now become almost a consensus in the sort of behavioral science literature that knowledge, education, and even attitude change is not a sufficient prerequisite for actual changing your behavior. And it isn't just changing your behavior, like we've said, for athletes. So it might be dietary habits or training habits, but it could be anything. For example, we've studied, behavioral scientists have studied, like how you improve bacterial infections in hospital and how you change through hand hygiene habits, getting people to wash hands frequently, recycling, energy conservation. And all of these challenges have at the heart of them a behavior change problem. And one of the things that I think about is There's really no, you know, one size fits all for it, because if you're in public health, which is the field I was in, is that you're trying to influence as many people as possible for most of the time. And you lose your ability just through scaling and cost to actually have an interpersonal interaction or a kind of a meaningful exchange with one-on-one, which is a potent, but it's really expensive to do that. And it's not very effective for large scale. So in clinics where people are coming, and you might be similar in this sense, that people are coming with some level of motivation already. And we know that motivation to change or intention to change is a really big starting point. But you also need the capacity to, or the capabilities to change. You need to know what you should do or how you need to do it. And then obviously context is important, or an opportunity. If you don't have, you know, someone saying you need to have this diet, but it's going to cost you an extra $500 a month to do that, and someone doesn't have the resources, it makes the behavior change problem even harder. Or you live in a food desert and it's really difficult to get, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables or so on. So context matters, or the environment matters too. But at the heart of the behavior change problem, I like to draw on one sort of method called motivational interviewing. And I don't know if you're familiar or you've had any discussions on this on your podcast in the past about this. And
I am familiar with it, and I've spent the morning watching presentations on motivational interviewing and just having a tremendously good time with it. And I realized that some of it I've learned just from working with so many clients. So we've got it so easy that people come to us. And at the moment, it's an $8,500 program. And so, you know, when you drop that much cash on solving a problem or meeting a goal, then you're sure as hell committed, right? And so the behavior change thing is so much easier.
It's a bit easier. Yeah. And I think this gets back to before even motivation interviewing. It's about someone's readiness to change. Mm-hmm. One of the models that we've been using for many, many years now, called the stages of change, or sometimes called the trans-theoretical model of change.
Right.
We're only psychologists come up with that. And there's some limitations of that and the new science, blah, blah, blah. But the essence is that behavior change is a bit like sort of buying a house, in the sense that it's not sort of one day you decide I want to buy a house and the next day you're in your new house. It's you go through a series of stages whereby you're contemplating, do I want to move, or is this right for me? But I like my house, you know. And then as you get nearer and nearer to getting a mortgage and looking and putting a deposit down, motivationally, you're shifting, you're building momentum for it. And so one of the disservices that we've done in the past, pre sort of, you know, having a scientific approach to this, is that we've treated everybody as they're ready to change, right? All they need is the right information or the right, and they're ready. And of course, you've only got to look in for people with chronic diseases or people who really struggle to make these changes. And some of them are not just resistant to change, but they're proud of not being changes. Right. Some of my relatives are like this. Well, you got to die from something, and I'd rather. What's the point of having an extra 5 years if it's going to be spent in a nursing home? And you know the way that it's rationalized or so on. So there's a lot of people who aren't even contemplating it. And so all our messaging and appeals to get people to do it, whether we're extolling the benefits of a good diet or activity or so on, are just lost on those people. The advertising campaigns, that so much money is wasted because it's going to screen out, or the people aren't even going to give attention to it, the people who need it most. And at the other extreme, you've got, you know, fitness programs in corporations, and they're, you know, the worried, well, we're training people, or we're giving resources to people who are already motivated and ready, but they're not the people who need it. So thinking of your readiness to change as a continuum, or sort of a state, you know, you're in these different stages moving towards when you're ready to commit, helps you think about what someone needs from you at any one particular point. And so the logic is that the goal as a behavior change person or a health coach or whatever, it's just to simply nudge people along that continuum. And even if that nudging isn't yet at the ability to, you're actually going to sign up, do it, start, you know, change a new habit, it might just be getting you to contemplate about what the advantages and disadvantages are and think about it. So I think that that is quite an important principle. And then tying it back to this motivational interviewing concept, which is an approach to talk, how you talk to people about changing, without getting into the kind of the weeds of it. But one of the fundamental principles is that we all have some ambivalence towards any change that we have in our lives, which means that we live with thoughts that are both in favor of changing and that oppose changing. And I've only got to think about my own life, not just training, but things like, oh, I really probably should cut down on my alcohol consumption or wine or beer consumption. And I know I need to, and I can list the five reasons why I need to. And I can also list the five reasons why I love drinking, right? So, so we all walk around with opposing thoughts in our heads, and psychologists often refer to this as cognitive dissonance, meaning you have dissonant or competing ideas or values or thoughts in your head about things. And that's why most people who smoke knows that it's probably going to give them lung cancer, but they, as a high risk, but they still do it. And so we all, most behavior change problems, we have some ambivalence towards. And when there is no ambivalence, change can be very quickly. And that might explain your ability to change overnight about cutting, because you didn't see any, there was nothing hanging on to these old thoughts and feelings about why, other than sort of, you know, fear of the unknown or cost or what have you. But if you're driven by, I'm so uncomfortable the way I am and I'll do anything to stop, then it does become a different behavior change problem. So motivational interviewing tries to kind of just pick away at people's natural ambivalence. It's part of the human condition, or the brain is to have to think about, to have two sides to every argument or change problem in your own head. And recognizing that we play tricks on ourselves all the time to kind of downplay one side and upplay the other, so we don't have to live with the constant fight in our heads. So we all use sort of dissonance reducing strategies. And we, you know, some of us know this as procrastination or denial, or, you know, we can, you've got to die of something, and you kind of rationalize it in such a way that it makes you able to live with those two competing thoughts. So what motivational interviewing is doing as a strategy is, rather than go out with a big finger wagging approach, is to actually approach it more to say, well, okay, let's find out what the natural ambivalence is in you. And so you talk about what are the advantages and disadvantages of staying the way you are and changing. And we're not asking you to change, we're just going to have that discussion. And then gradually you're just picking away at the advantages and the disadvantages, so that change ends up being motivated from within. And that's the most powerful form of change, when it's intrinsic, when it's self-motivated, it's not sort of, you know, prescriptive or finger waggy. And I think that's the one of the hallmarks of most behavior change challenges, is to find out what that ambivalence was, and then use a whole suite of techniques that we know in behavioral science that help you move you closer towards action.
Do you think ambivalence could be a source of anxiety?
Absolutely. In fact, that's really what ambivalence, or I should say, you know, that dissonance creates. And because the human brain does not like to have competing, I should say, opposing thoughts, because having opposing thoughts creates anxiety and it creates emotion to try and resolve that. And emotions are there to ultimately to drive decision making, then that's one of the little signals or the nudge in the ribs to get us to do something. But people deal with anxiety in different ways. And so some people confront it head on and try and unpack what it means and what they can do to get out of it. Other people use denial as a strategy, or they use procrastination as a strategy. And so the ambivalence part is, using the procrastination example, is to say, wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to procrastinate anymore? You just kind of knew what you needed to do and you had, and you did it. And you get people to experience, even if it's sort of, you know, fictitiously, thinking about what it would be like to live without this burden or without this anxiety that's caused by this. So yeah, absolutely, it does cause it.
Wow. Yeah, that's it's been so insightful. One thing I did recognize from watching some presentations on motivational interviewing this morning was this idea that you're not being counseled by an expert, but rather there's a peer-to-peer relationship, right? So when I'm on a call with a client doing a coaching thing, it's clear, right? I'm a computer programmer, right? I'm not a doctor or a psychologist or someone else. You know, I'm just a guy that rides bikes just like you, and I've solved some of the problems that you're trying to solve. And so I feel like it's obvious that I'm not an expert. And when we talk about things, it's like kind of almost like talking with friends rather than, you know, me being the expert, handing down the expert advice, the prescription, so to speak.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, and this is what empathy is, right? Being able to just put yourself in someone else's shoes and recognize that it's hard. And when people, and the coaches, sport coaches, are notoriously guilty of this, is that, you know, they'll say, if an athlete doesn't do the training, or they're just like, listen, I can only help you so much, right? If you're not going to do the work, you need to find another coach, because I'm not the coach for you. And it's sort of that prescriptive model. And really, you know, when you enter into a relationship, a facilitative one, you're trying to nurture change. And I think if someone does not feel judged or evaluated or criticized, and that's really what we're saying, if we want to unpack the non, you know, if we want to say that the peer, why the peer approach works, is because ultimately you're removing those things that you're feeling criticized or judged. And but when you're in a position of power, you can do that if you have the skills to do it. So it's all about framing and context rather than just the fact that you, you know, you're a physician or a health coach or what have you. But some people have the personality for it, that their upbringing and their general dispositions, that they're able to communicate on a very fundamental level. And we know, for example, one interesting finding in the psychological research is that people form trusted relationships based especially in moments of vulnerability and weakness. In other words, we bond on vulnerability and weaknesses. We don't bond on strengths. So being able to open up and shed self, this is why therapists are trained to use self-disclosure to say, I struggle with this too. And if you don't struggle with it, you can kind of create or invent scenarios where you're empathic to it. So at least they don't feel judged or evaluated. That's one of the secrets of doing it. And you found it organically, or you just, you're naturally like that. But it's also a skill that we can all learn to be better at.
A really cool example of the exact opposite was highlighted in one of the presentations I watched. And I should thank Teresa Rodriguez, who's a coach and a close personal friend. She first sent me this video. You've probably seen it. It's Bob Newhart's Stop It. Have you seen that video?
Yeah.
It's the most fantastic thing. I'll link to it in the show notes so that people
can find it. Yeah, that's hilarious.
But in a nutshell, it's the therapist who's giving therapy to this woman who's claustrophobic. And she says, do you think I should write down this advice? And he says, no, it's only two words. Like, most people can remember two words. And the two words are, stop it. And so the whole sketch goes on for 6 minutes. It's very, very funny. I should link to it.
The snap out of it, therapeutic advice, right? We all find ourselves doing it. We're all, you know, and I'm not a parent, but I know many friends who are parents, and they find themselves, you know, just don't argue, just don't do it anymore, you know, and we all do it. So it's not something that is sort of necessarily even that to be admonished. It's you know, life. But it's recognizing when we're doing it and learning, well, how could I approach this in a different way? And you can learn that if it doesn't come naturally to you.
And I'm sure that it's driven in part by the clinician or the coach or whoever it is that's giving the advice or trying to create the behavior change, is they've seen this problem so many times before and they're too anxious to get to the solution, right? To stop it. Like, I know how to solve this problem. Just do this. And it's that kind of, because the clinician has seen it before, they're really anxious to get to the solution.
It's interesting. So one of the areas that have been studied fairly consistently is counseling for diet and exercise change in primary care, and like how doctors do it, when they do it, or if they do it at all, and for whom do they do it. And what we know is that it rarely happens. When I say rarely, about for patients who are showing, who have conditions or outcomes in which diet change and exercise change would help, it's only done about 30% of the time. And that, there's lots of reasons for that. It's not always the physicians don't like training. It's time, you know, when you look at the length of a clinical visit and so on. And there are programs designed, research programs. I've been involved in one of them. It's called PACE, and it's a how you train physicians to counsel for diet and exercise in under 2 minutes. And so it is difficult. We know that physicians generally don't do a very good job of it. And that's partly time, but also training. And if you just peek at medical education, and I've been involved in preventive medicine residency programs and undergraduate medical education, and you see the lack of behavioral science training or exercise counseling or nutritional counseling in there. So we shouldn't be too surprised that that doesn't happen. And I think some clinicians just feel also, if they are, you know, if you're overweight or obese as a physician and you're counseling a patient, you feel a bit embarrassed about it because you're not, or they're going to look at you. Or they have one of the findings of the research is that they have a fundamental assumption. It's anecdotal, but it's based on, you know, their own experiences, that what I say never seems to matter or make any difference. Because when I see them in 12 months and I could tell them all that, and I've done it all my professional life, and they still come back and there hasn't made any difference, then it becomes the sort of the nuts and bolts of how you do it. And that's one of the reasons what they're saying is, look, education doesn't really matter. It doesn't really help that much. And we know that.
So what do you do if you've only got 2 minutes? Summarize that research?
I can't. So one of the core elements was thinking, just educating clinicians in terms of this stages model. So being able to ask certain questions so that you have a good sense of their readiness to change. And rather than just assuming that everyone, all they need is this missing piece, and they're ready to step over the threshold and do it. And to be consistent in the delivery of that information. So one of the things that we also know from the research, for example, is that, and it's not just physicians, but, you know, people in the primary care setting who are in that environment, it might be a one-off piece of advice or a pamphlet or a little reminder, but it's not followed up. So the next time they see him. So I remember, like, you know, last time we talked about this, how's that been going? Or did you try? And it's not reinforced. So having the ability to know where people are at and to provide some skills at the moment. So one of the fundamental skills is awareness, self-monitoring in psych parlance. And, you know, probably 50 to 60% of the battle is getting people to be aware of what they're actually doing, because we make all of these wonderful, all these cognitive acrobatics that we do in our own heads to convince us that our problem isn't as bad or as serious as we think, because we've been on this dissonance reducing, you know, calm self-medicating approach. And so being able to know exactly what the issue is. So that's where, you know, getting people to use some measurement technologies, whether it in, you know, activity, it might be a pedometry or just getting testing or something, and then following up. So having people have a fundamental assumption of what the issue is critical. And then having some goals and ways that you enact those goals. So the PACE program is really based about staging people, getting them to move one stage forward, which doesn't always mean that you need to be exercising the next time I see you, but it's just getting them to contemplate it and then reinforcing that discussion as they go on. But, you know, as you know, the touch points in primary care are few and far between and people are rushed and it's really difficult to do well.
Do you think it could ever be done by technology?
Yeah, there are lots of attempts to try and do that, in fact, now. And one of the great findings in the self-monitoring research, and this is the, you know, this is also, I know that you're interested in quantified self stuff and is sort of a very allied field here, is that it's the frequency of which you monitor yourself that's important, not the quality. So in other words, you know, academics have got so bogged down in the accuracy of our measurement tools just simply to convey feedback. And that's important. You know, you want good, valid and reliable measures. Otherwise, how do you have a considerable? They're all accurate. But what we know from the psychological research is that the more often you do it, meaning you try and find feedback about how you're doing, even if that feedback is slightly biased or not very precise, it doesn't matter as much as the fact that you're bringing into conscious attention and thinking about it. So the frequency of monitoring is really important. In fact, and so technology lends itself really well to that. You know, there's a whole there's a whole sort of movement in using digital tech platforms or mobile technologies to improve health outcomes. And the interventions, they're called just-in-time interventions. I don't know if you've ever come across those, JIT interventions. And what this means is that usually they revolve around smartphones with data that's kind of, you know, ever-present and passive to the user, that we're getting valuable information about when is the right time to intervene and prompt in such a way that it's not obtrusive and annoying, and it can be subtle, but it's sufficiently frequent to keep it on their sort of radar, because most of our bad habits are exactly that. They're habits. They're not actually in our conscious thought. So when you need to break a bad habit or even start a new one, before we can sort of chug it down into our procedural memory or the place that sort of runs our autopilots and habits, is that we have to put it into our conscious thinking. We have to dissect it by, you know, the cue, routine and reward, neurological loop, as it were, for creating habits. We have to think about it and engineer our circumstances to do that. So digital and mobile technologies are wonderful tools for doing that, because they're both simultaneous harvesters of data about that person. And it's very individualized and personalized. And people always have these devices with them. You know, it's the most valuable real estate is probably your home screen on your phone at the moment, right?
And can you name any apps that are doing this?
Most of them that are really embedded with good behavioral science, rather than they're just sort of, you know, startups that are throwing eggs at a wall and seeing if they stick, are still in the academic world, meaning they're being, you know, tested with randomized controlled trials and so on.
Okay.
There are some really good self-monitoring apps like Breadcrumbs. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No.
So it's really, you know, using your phone to give you, and in fact, it's built into a lot of mapping apps now, or tracking apps, I should say, in our phones. It'll tell you where you've been today without really you entering any other information, just that, you know, it's kind of got hard fixes on your location and it logs it with a timestamp and it tries to put some context around it. And so you can learn about what you do and when. And there's no surprise that most iPhones like the iOS phones like this, but Android now, they'll have built-in apps that are have like a health component to them that will measure your steps. They're not very well, but that may not matter if it's frequency that's important. And it can ping you and give you feedback to tell you how you're doing. So I think it's still very much in the infancy phase for things that are actually going to be rolled out and useful. But, you know, Apple Watches now have sort of haptic feedback, you know, vibration feedback. If you've been sitting for too long, and it will just remind you to get up and walk for 3 minutes or so on. These are all technologies that are available now are going in the right direction. They're just sort of quite, you know, basic at the moment.
Do you think it's going to make a difference whether these are qualitative measures or subjective? So personally, I feel like I've gotten really good results by staying away from my smartphone and making a habit out of noticing. And the first person to make me really think hard about this was Ellen Langer. So I go on about this all the time on the podcast. The reason I go on about it all the time is because I've made a habit of it, right? So I always think about how my ankles don't hurt anymore because I do tons of walking. And I got a laser eye surgery, and now I notice that I can see things far into the distance, whereas before I needed glasses or contact lenses. And, you know, maybe I'm walking down the street in Lisbon like I was today, and I'm holding my daughter's hand. And I think about, you know, how lonely I was before when I didn't have a girlfriend and I really wanted to start a family and it wasn't happening for me. And now I have what I want, right? She's holding my hand right now as we walked out. And so I'm noticing these small things. So it's not high tech. It's not a bunch of biofeedback, but maybe it's still effective. And so do you think that's a good strategy, or do you think I'm better off counting steps with my smartphone?
I think that's what's called a leading question.
It's somewhat of a loaded question, but I'm perfectly willing. If you told me, I honestly believe, if you were to tell me, no, you need to be tracking something, here's the evidence that suggests that real numbers are going to make a difference for you, this will lead to a better outcome, I would totally do it.
No, I think this is a good one of those good examples of that, you know, we have to be very careful in how we interpret the science here, because when scientific studies are done on self-monitoring through remote sensing and so on, is that they're very clean clinical environments. And, you know, we're trying to distill down into what the essential elements are that are driving change. But it's still a study of averages, right? And we've done, you know, I've been involved in interventions to reduce weight, body weight, that are delivered entirely through text messaging and just through Facebook. And we know that some people just do not engage or do not enjoy those technologies. It's not about technological literacy at all. That's a separate issue. It's just about that's not a medium that they find helps them. So it is very individualized. And I would say that the best use of technology is more facilitative or supportive of how you already kind of enjoy that, or not enjoy, but how you already, what you already find that works for you. So I would say for you, the smartphone or sensing, remote sensing can still work, but it has to still be effective for you, but it has to support ways that you find are already helpful. So trying to switch you over to just a pure, you know, a quantified self nerd, where you're measuring, you know, 27 biomarkers in real time, may not actually be what does it for you. But a device that can help you have more instances where you remember that you're enjoying walking down the road holding your daughter's hand is really powerful. You know, our memories are associative and emotive driven. And so the more we can hang experiences, or more we can hang our behavior change experiences on things that we feel are, you know, important with our value system and connected to emotions that we like, the better. So it doesn't just always have to be like either or.
Right. Yeah. And I should explain the reason why that's so powerful for me, thinking about that I'm holding my daughter's hand, was it was behavior change that led to meeting the woman that then became my wife, that led to having kids. And a large part of that was changing my diet, you know, changing how much I was prioritizing sleep and all the other things that we talked about on the podcast. So that's kind of what keeps me going, is knowing that I've achieved that incredible goal.
Again, humans are goal driven. And what the reason that self-monitoring works is it gives us feedback about how we're doing for that goal. That's all that it, you know, the whole theory is about why that works and how, but that's it in essence. So if you, for folks who don't have problem setting goals or find it quite easy to set implementation of goal plans, like how am I going to do this, when and where, feedback may not be as critical, but those of us who struggle with that, feedback in a timely way, in the moment when you need it, when you're about to make that, you know, quart of ice cream purchase or whatever it happens to be for you that you struggle with, then that's quite important. And that's when context awareness of a device is can help us make really better decisions, right? Because most of our decisions are made, if you just leave them up to themselves, they're either guilt driven, like, oh my God, I can't believe I've done this again. I'm not going to do it tomorrow. Okay, tomorrow, the whole New Year's resolution concept is based on that. But if you've got something that knows that you're in aisle four of wherever and telling you that you're vulnerable to making a purchase, an emotional purchase that you're probably going to regret later, and being able to be pinged at that particular time, that could have an important effect on your behavior.
Well, that could be super cool. Yeah, that's a really, really good idea. I wanted to talk to you about the method that we've been using to facilitate behavior change in our practice. And it is rather tech heavy, although to be fair, it doesn't have to be. And maybe you're familiar with it, but I'll explain it anyway. Are you familiar with the Agile Scrum Sprint?
Yes. Yeah.
You are familiar with that. All right. Okay. So for the listeners, I'll explain what we do. I meet with a client and we're communicating one-on-one over Zoom. And maybe I should talk about an example that just happened to come up yesterday. Was somebody was only able to find, I think it was either 5 or 6 hours to sleep because they thought they had to get up early in order to run so that they could qualify for this marathon. And I thought, well, maybe the sleep is more important. And we did the kind of motivational interviewing thing where it's all about change talk, right? Are the keywords. Like, you get the person to suggest that maybe they would be a better runner if only they could get some more sleep. And we talked about what they had to do in order to make that happen. They said, what do you do in the morning? Well, you know, I've got to take the kids to school. Or how far away is the school? Like, is there another way that you could get the kids to school other than driving? You know, it emerged that they like to ride bikes and there was a kid seat that they could put on the bike. And maybe that person could get fitter by riding the kids to school with the kid in the car seat. And okay, so now what do we need to do in order to make this happen? Well, you know, the kid seat doesn't fit on the bike anymore. And so the whole time we're speaking, I'm looking at this thing that we call a Kanban board. And there are columns to do, doing, review, and done. And we use a piece of software called Trello to implement the Kanban board. But equally, you could do it on a whiteboard, right? You could have these columns on a whiteboard. And then, you know, as we're talking, we're thinking of things, well, this needs to be done in order for this to happen. So I'll write on a sticky note, take bike to bike shop to get kid seat fixed, right? And that goes in the to-do column. And then obviously we talk for a while. And at the end of the session, there's a whole bunch of these sticky notes. And I'm very careful about how many sticky notes I put in the to-do column, because if you put in too many, then nothing tends to happen. And then we say, okay, what are you doing in 2 weeks? And then we meet again in 2 weeks' time. And then we repeat the process. And so if something has gone wrong in that two-week period, we can then reassess very early on rather than, you know, oh, I'll see you in. And so in the beginning, what we used to do is I would write down things on a piece of paper, you know, like a series of bullet points, and you would just hand it to the person. And guess what? Nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. And so I feel like we've been getting really great results with the Scrum system. And I should recommend, there's a really good book. It's called Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland, that I will link in the show notes. But what do you think about this, Simon? Am I doing it wrong? Could I be doing it better?
No, this is great. I mean, in psych speak, these would be called implementation intentions.
Okay.
And we know, for example, that, you know, if there's one phrase that would summarize about, you know, how we work towards goals, is that goal setting is not your problem, right? For most people, they know pretty much, assuming that it's not some real sort of esoteric area or something that they're totally, but when we're talking about lifestyle change, most people know what they need to do. You know, there might be a little bit of education component, but it's not that, it's how you implement a goal. And so implementation intentions, we're watching the most important, which is one of the most important way techniques that you change behavior, is you're really thinking through how, okay, I want to be able to get my exercise in, but not take more, you know, but not be having to substitute time for this. So I'm going to do it. I'm trying to combine my commute with my exercise. Then how do you do it? So you're listing all the ways that problems that might be along the ways, or what if this doesn't fit on your bike? So how can we work towards that? So you're implementing or teaching people how to implement a strategy that's going to help them meet that goal. And so that's a really powerful technique. And in fact, this is a good point to kind of have a little bit of a selling point of a resource for readers in the science. So in behavioral science, one researcher in particular who's done a wonderful job of of saying, well, what's important and when and for whom in terms of behavioral science, of which implementation intentions is one, is a woman called Dr. Susan Michie, M-I-C-H-I-E. And she's at UCL in London, and she's a health psychologist, actually a clinical psychologist, and she leads up this called the Human Behavior Change Project. And it's a consortium of experts in behavioral science to figure out what the core elements of behavior change are. So they call them BCTs, the behavior change techniques. So what does the literature, what does the scientific literature tell us about what's effective for changing people's behaviors across a whole host of different behaviors? And they've come up with this taxonomy, this list of things that have evidence behind them. And there are 93 of them now, which all have evidence behind them. And they've been grouped according to things like, you know, how you set goals and so on. And what the goal of the Human Behavior Change Project is to then use artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language processing to kind of automate the process of mining the new scientific studies for when something comes on to tell us, is this, has this kind of dropped down in importance or is it less important? You know, 200 studies a day are being published in behavior change. It's impossible for us to keep up with this. And we, the dictum of the meta-analyst or the person who statistically reviews studies is to say that, listen, we know a lot more than we've actually proved, because there's all these studies out there. So we need help. And so the goal is to try and learn from the studies we have at the moment. And out of this taxonomy, we've been able to do some quite remarkable analyses to say, listen, if you do have limited time and you are to invest in, like, what are the key things that I need to focus on? We can learn from these studies. And so, for example, you know, helping people have good implementation intentions, where exactly what you're doing, is one of the top five things that we know that we can do to help. Self-monitoring is another, right? You have to be aware of it. It doesn't always have to be technology driven. So things like that are really quite powerful. And I think that, you know, by learning from what the science is telling us and how we kind of implement those and how we provide good quality feedback or how we review what went wrong when we set goals or couldn't perform them, these things are potent behavioral strategies and there's good evidence to show that they work. So that science is evolving, but I think that's a long-winded way of saying what you're doing, however you found that strategy or why it works, it's supported by evidence, and I would say keep doing it.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I can't take credit for it, obviously. It was just something that I learned from my previous life as a software engineer. Software engineers, in my experience, and I'm sure there are exceptions, and people who listen to this will take exception if you are a software engineer, are some of the laziest people I've ever met. Almost by definition, right? Because if you were not lazy, you would do it by hand, right? Say you've got some data entry task, you want to put a load of numbers in a spreadsheet, and it's a series of numbers, and somehow you can write an algorithm that creates the series automatically. Well, maybe a non-programmer would do that manually, but a programmer would find a way to automate it, and that's because they're lazy. And of course, this is a positive for some tasks, and then it has this downside that they tend not to get things done. And I think the Scrum method is a fantastic way of getting lazy programmers to get shit done. And you know, that's just what I was used to.
Exactly. And it's also kind of a metaphor, it's kind of a simile, I suppose, for the human brain, right? This is what our brain does, is when we find tasks that are initially quite complicated, and if we have to think about them all the time in our conscious thought, it would paralyze us because we have to make whatever, 30,000 decisions a day. So that's the purpose of habits. So we're always trying to find shortcuts. But the challenge is when those shortcuts start to kick us in the ass, because, you know, we're doing things out of habit and we're not realizing, because they're no longer in our conscious thought. We're actually just being, you know, and one of the most common is helping people cut down on alcohol use. And we know that habits, you know, pouring the second glass or whatever, we become so habituated to our environment. And the cues in our environment that trigger us to overdrink. And we can help that by changing or trying to eliminate those triggers rather than just try and have willpower to fight against them. What's staring at a bottle that's already open is not as nearly a good strategy as hiding the bottle or not having the bottle in the house to begin with, right? And it's the same for being productive. The most cue, eliminating the cue or the trigger for productivity, is turn your phone off. Simple, for that hour that you're trying to do that, or close your email program down so you're not being distracted. So yeah, I think that's a good metaphor for what the brain does naturally anyway.
Awesome. And how do you do it with your coaching? So is behavior change an issue when you do the sports psych stuff? Do you ever have this problem where you just really need that client to just stop doing something?
Our entry point for athletes is, do you ever have thoughts and feelings that you don't want? And if anyone is human, they will say yes. And if they say no, that they're either lying or on psychotropic meds. So the starting point is yes. And so really behavior change is, how do I have fewer of those thoughts? It becomes a behavior change problem. So one of the most common examples is at age group, just not applicable to age group, all athletes, regardless of whether they kind of go through this cycle of, they enjoy the training. Some of it's hard, obviously, and they enjoy kind of the racing when it's over. But the morning of a race, when their stomach's churning and they're sweating and they're like, why do I do this to myself? And this is not a fucking fun experience, right? Mm. Or they have those thoughts of escape, what psychologists call in the first hour, I'm never doing this again. Who said this was a good idea? What was I thinking? I just want to be gone. And you're hoping that you get a flat tire to end your misery. And we all do on a fairly consistent basis. Yeah, so I forget what the train of thought I had there. I lost
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so how do you get how does the behavior change? Right. So how do you do it?
This is an ambivalence issue, right? I want to race, but I don't enjoy this part of it. I want to race, but I don't enjoy this. That becomes what can I do to make the experience a bit more enjoyable? And often the behavior might be learning a skill so that you start to reframe some of the symptoms or feelings that your body's giving you. So it's not about nervousness, nausea, and heaviness. It's about feeling light and ready, and that fight is all, this endocrinological changes that are really helping you be the fastest athlete that you can be on the day. And we want you to need to crap five times, and we want your palms to be sweaty because this is helping your grip and this is making you as light as possible. So a lot of it is learning those strategies to reframe. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that you're learning a physical skill. I mean, a physical skill in the sense that you have to listen to something and get, develop mindfulness. Like meditation, right, is a great example. We try, and a lot of our athletes use the app Headspace. Mm. And you may have heard of that. Headspace. Just as a skill for learning how to have passive attention or stay in the here and now. And they're the building blocks of having a process focus during sport. So learning that skill, that's a behavior change problem. Oh, I don't like meditation. You say the word meditation to an athlete and their eyes all spin around like a one-armed bandit at a casino. So we never mention the word meditation. We talk about creating headspace for you.
It's one of the best named apps ever, isn't it? It really is.
It is. And it works for lots of reasons. And it's, Andy Puddicombe, the main guy behind it, who has also a British guy, he also has just a wonderful voice for it. Mm. And so it's a lot of elements that have, come together, and the packaging of it, and you don't feel stupid, and there's no kind of spiritual or ethereal or kumbaya-y Enya listening, drum circle to it. It's just about, listen, wouldn't it be nice just to step away out of your day and just clear some of the shit, just have time for yourself, just to chill out. Create some headspace for yourself. And what you're doing is learning skills of meditation, but we don't call them that. So that skill is one of the things that getting people to start and learn that is a behavior change problem for athletes, because they kick it, I'm too fidgety, I've tried it in the past, or I'm just not for me. And so how do you get someone to try something that they don't like doing? That's a behavior change problem.
And so how do you solve it?
Right. So one thing is how you frame it. So we zero in on headspace and why is important and what it is and how you talk about what meditation is or what it isn't. You get people to set very short-term goals. And one of the great things about headspace that is that I want you to practice for 10 minutes a day for 10 days. And people say, well, I can do that. If you say, I want you to start taking a few yoga classes or going to a meditation, oh God, I've got to find out where they are and I've got to, go up and I feel like a bit of a chump. I don't know what I'm doing. And what if they ask me to do it? So you can do it in the comfort of your own home. I've given them a very small, tangible goal, 10 minutes a day for 10 days. We're going to check in 10 days time and see how you're doing. So I'm giving them implementation intentions. I want you to download this app. I want you to find a time where you're quiet. You're not trying to sleep. So it doesn't send you sleep when you practice it here. So they can do it. Setting them some goals. I want you to do some self-monitoring of it. The app is built in that says, oh, congratulations, you've now done 37 minutes of headspace training. And then you have a goal autopsy in 10 days' time. We talk about how they've done. And so that is behavior change. it's kind of embedding those principles into the technique or the skill that you're trying to get them to work on.
One thing you taught me, which I think is critically important when working with the athlete, is it has to be about performance, right? And I'm not sure you made that crystal clear there, but perhaps you intended it, is that, you know, the athlete, they care about the time, like how long did it take me to finish this event? And so if you frame it, or power to weight ratio for cyclists, for example, so you could say to that person, okay, if you do this, if you get through this program of doing Headspace for the next 10 days, I think it's going to improve your power to weight ratio. And athletes are like, really? And like, yes, really. And here's, you know, here's the evidence, if you like. But for me, it's so powerful when you say that to an athlete, this is going to make you faster. This is going to make you better.
It is. Yeah, that was more. So yeah, all of this, when you're selling, for want of a word, these techniques to athletes, they're all driven by our goal is to make you faster and happier, right? Just making you happier and not making you any faster. Most athletes are like, meh, or just making you happier and not faster. They're like, well, so it's, you know, in professional athletes, just being faster, but I'm even more miserable. And my relationship's even worse now. And so that doesn't work either. So we're trying to combine the two. So obviously at all points, the goal is to help you become the better athlete. And that involves often become faster, more efficient, or so on.
Do you have space in your coaching practice to help people that might be listening to this podcast? Are you just working with the Leslie Pattersons and Team BMCs of this world? Or
no, not at all. In fact, Leslie and I run an endurance sport coaching business together, and Leslie does the physical coaching and I do the mental coaching, although it's actually much more integrated than that sounds. But we also have our own separate sort of clients, in one word. So some folks don't want anything to do with mental training, or they might already have things down and they only work with Leslie, or folks have their own coaches and they only work with me on shoring up their mental game, which for them is having fewer thoughts and things they don't want. So we do all, and that ranges from folks who have, and obviously from my background in working with people with chronic disease, is starting a new lifestyle that's very different than the one they have now. And it might be, you know, just doing your very first 5K or something, or just getting off the couch a bit more often, right through to professional world champions. So that it really runs the gamut, and the principles are amazingly consistent. They work consistently across all groups. It's just the kind of the focus and the goals change slightly, but absolutely.
Persuade me why I should read The Brave Athlete.
Okay, so the Brave Athlete is essentially a guide, a workbook to help you have fewer thoughts and feelings that you don't want. And these apply to you as an athlete, but they also apply to your other human life as well. And we perform as a, you know, as a little window to how we are as people. So in terms of how you are in your relationships and your job, and it wasn't designed for that, but the principles are all the same. So the first thing is, it'll help you have thoughts and things you don't want. And the second real big piece is that we've met athletes where they're already at. So unlike a lot of the psychology self-help books, which are very technique focused, like here's a book about stress management, we found that real people don't come to you and say, I need more psychological and emotional strength to run a half marathon. They say, I need to harden the fuck up. What's wrong with me? You know, I find I throw the towel in too. So the chapters are framed around how athletes experience different areas that are at the root of which are thoughts and feelings they don't want. So some is about, I feel fat, or dealing with feeling, you know, having thoughts that might be on a weekly or a daily basis about your body image. Some are about, I seem to, you know, I just can't get out of my comfort zone. I don't do things that scare me. Others is about coping with pain tolerance. Others are about improving my identity as an athlete. I want to look in the mirror and not just see an athlete. I want to feel like an athlete, but I don't feel I'm enough. I don't feel deserving of being called an athlete. So all of these issues, we've tried to meet where the athlete would have and then unpack the science of it and show, here's some real world examples and their case studies of athletes we worked with. This is what it looks like in practice, about how we help you with that. There are case studies, there are worksheets, there are exercises for each of these 13 problems, the most common that we've found athletes tell us that they have.
How do you get the worksheets done? So I found this to be a problem in general, and I know you know about it. It's the problem of the online course, right? So in the beginning, I did all these online courses and I got fantastic results with that because I really needed to start a business, right? I quit my job at a hedge fund and the pressure was kind of on. You know, I had a 6-month-old baby and a mortgage to pay, and I got shit done when it came to online courses. And nowadays, I feel like the technical side of our business is not really a problem. It's more about sales and marketing, actually. And so when I do these functional medicine training courses or biochemistry or physiology, whatever it is, there's very little pressure on me to get that stuff done. And so guess what? Nothing happens. And so the same, I find the same, you know, when books contain these worksheets and I want you to do this and I want you to write down five things that you're grateful for this morning, you know, maybe I'll get it done for 1 or 2 days and then I very quickly fall off the wagon. So how do you make that happen consistently?
Well, it's obviously it's hard. The challenge is much harder if you're in a, you know, if you're communicating through a printed book.
Right. You're limited.
Yeah, you're very little interaction, if any. So interpersonal or in-person coaching, either over the phone or Skype, in combination with these exercises, is always going to be more powerful. But I think it's a behavioral science problem itself, right? Getting you to do stuff. So having exercises that are in small, manageable chunks, that there is some outcome or performance, tangible performance improvement that you can show in the scientific literature. So the gratefulness is a good example. And gratefulness for athletes is, you know, one of the things that we try and get people to work towards. There's a lot of reasons why that is. But in essence, what the research shows, for example, is that if you sort of write down three things that you're grateful for every day for 3 consecutive weeks, and there are randomized controlled trials of this, that mental health, different indicators of mental health improve. 3 weeks, not 2 weeks, not 1 week, not 10 days. It's like the 10 minutes a day for 10 days. So you're trying to tie it to, this is a threshold where we know this stuff will start to work and you'll start to feel it, rather than this sort of open-ended, well, try this. And if you don't, doesn't know, move on. And so wherever possible to try and do that. But in the printed form, it's really difficult. We can be engaging. That's one of the reasons that we try and use a bit more irreverent language in the way that we write and communicate. It's kind of fun. It's an exercise. It might be packaged in a way or explained in a way that's a bit more fun than a dry sort of, you know, academic exercise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think all of those things, but at the end of the day, you've got to be like taking a stages of change approach. You've got right. to be motivated to want to do it, right? You've got to have the capability and opportunity. So we're saying, listen, we're teaching you the skills. That's the capability. We're giving you an opportunity. We've actually printed a book with a worksheet you can write in it, so you don't have to find a piece of paper or type. And then you have to be motivated. And the fact that you've bought the book to begin with tells us that you're probably motivated. So you try and combine those things in turn. And then, you know, and I think once it really encouraged people to share their success stories of trying this stuff. And that really is far more powerful than having, you know, a world champ or a PhD noggin to explain about it. When real people say, I've created an alter ego and I used it on Saturday and this is what it did and this is what happened. We love seeing those stories because, right. you know, we don't know these people have done it, but they've tried it and they've found that it works and they're telling other people about it. And that's ultimately a huge source of behavior change for others, right? You're seeing other people be successful with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have one last question for you. I promise I could keep you on Skype all day long, but I have one last question. And that's, when will there be an audible version of the book? I'm very
audio.
Much an audible.
So we record, Leslie and I are recording that actually, which will be funny for 7 reasons. We're recording it in 2 weeks' time, actually. It's taken us a while to get it done because, one, generally audiobooks, they don't, as I've learned, publishers don't generally like the authors recording their own work.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, there are lots of reasons for that. Diction of one and, you know, maybe whatever. And there are some voices that are more pleasing on the ear than others and so on. But we felt it was really important for us to be the ones who narrate it. And this may bite us in the ass when people listen to Leslie or me and can't understand a fuck anything she's saying. Right? But we'll try and enunciate and as much as possible. So yes, we're recording it in a couple of weeks and then it'll probably be out in November time, early December, I imagine, on all the usual audible channels.
I will very much look forward to that. Where's the best place to send people? Is it the... You do an athlete smog on braveheartcoaching.com, correct?
We do. Our braveheartcoach.com athlete site, we have what's called a smog test or an MOT test if you're British.
Yes.
And what this is that athletes or anybody, I suppose, who are interested in trying to change their behavior for sport or health, they email us, they tell us there's some questions on it, and they're just, what are you doing at the moment? And what are you trying to improve on? And what you get better at? And then Leslie or I, depending on what the focus is, gives you a call for like 10 minutes. And it's a no strings attached chance to just talk about what it is you're struggling with. And originally, you know, our goal there, okay, in a very selfish way, we're trying to, you know, help people understand them if they want to sign us up as coaches. But that's not really the goal, the main goal. It was to sort of get people to think about their training in a new or different way. And sometimes it means us that we're pointing them in directions that will help them that don't involve us at all. So the smog test is a nice opportunity to have a talk about what you're doing at the moment and how you might do things differently if you'll find that you're stale or you're struggling to meet your goals or so on.
Awesome. Well, Simon, this has been fantastic. An absolute pleasure. And I hope that I will be able to get you back onto the podcast at some point in the future.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.